You're listening to the Barry Egan Tapes here on News Talk. I'm Barry Egan from the Sun Independent, and I'm talking to Louise O'Neill. Louise, thanks for coming in. Can you just take me back to when you were seven, when you first learned the meaning of rape and abortion?
I suppose that was the year of the X case in Ireland, which I think most people, well, of a certain age will remember. It was a young girl who accused, she was raped by a family friend, and she became pregnant. And then her family wanted to bring her to the UK for an abortion, and they were stopped by the Attorney General, or the Attorney General got an injunction, and she ended up miscarrying in the end. But I think that case was all over the news, like you just couldn't escape it. So it was all over the TV, all over the radio, all over the papers.
You say people of a certain age, but certainly not 7 year olds.
Yeah, well, I think I had a really advanced reading age, so which was something I think my parents found a little bit troubling, you know, because they were
brought up on the bell jar, were you?
Yeah, well, not quite, but I would pick up books that, like, my mother was reading or her magazines, and then ask slightly inappropriate questions around the one that I remember was asking what masturbation was, and there was just this complete like silence around the table. I think it was around 8, maybe 9. So I always had at around 8, I would have had the reading age of a 16-year-old.
How are you doing now?
What to say? I'm just about 17 or 18 now. I'm just, you know, doing my best. So, yeah, so I suppose because of that, you know, I suppose it was harder to protect me from certain things because I could read them.
But you didn't want to be protected from certain things?
No, obviously, for a 7-year-old, you know, the notion of rape and abortion are not really...
How did that affect you?
I remember feeling really frightened because... Actually, what was funny about that case was not necessarily the rape or not necessarily the abortion. But for me as a small child, at that age, you think of your parents as these godlike figures. You know, they have control over every aspect of your life. You know, when you go to bed, what you eat, just everything. You know, your parents are, they're in charge. And I think what was really frightening about that case was that that girl's parents wanted to bring her to the UK, that they wanted to help her. And that the state interfered in that relationship and that they had more control ultimately than her parents did. And I actually found that really frightening that, you know, that in a way that even though I had sort of accepted that my parents had control over me in certain ways, because that seemed very natural, the thought of the state or the church having control over me and like forcing a child to stay pregnant, that was really terrifying.
And the church, not so much the church, but the state has had control over women's bodies. Well, and the church.
And the church, yes, for sure.
For a long time.
I mean,
time.
They have, you know, conspired really together.
What's the legacy of that?
It's really interesting, you know, because I think that when I grew up, you know, I really, I suppose, came of age at a really interesting time because I was born in 1985 and, homosexuality was only legalised in the 90s and divorce was legalised in the 90s. And it went from, I suppose, a country where there was no sex at all to all of a sudden Ann Summer shops opening up, you know, in every main street, in every town type thing. And I think that there was no space actually for a moment in between where that it went from no sex at all to being hypersexualized, and there was no moment, I think, for women to just sort of embrace their sexuality. And the problem with that was that while we had that jump from, as I said, no sex to a lot of sex, I think the shame that was attached to sex that was very much ingrained in us by our religious upbringing, I think that that wasn't quite unpicked at the same rate as the sexualization of our society. And I've read a lot around the theories of inherited shame or inherited trauma, where they've done these studies on rats where that they will give them a smell of, let's say, lavender, and then give them an electric shock. And then when they have children, and then when the rats have children, and then their grandchildren and their great-grandchildren, they'll give the great-grandchildren a smell of lavender, and those rats will actually act as if they've had an electric shock, because the connection between the lavender and the electric shock has actually been transferred in their DNA. So I think it's really interesting when you think of all of the women in particular, but I suppose, you know, Irish people as a whole, the way that we were taught to connect sex and shame.
How did you eventually disconnect the two?
I think that's really just a learning process. And I think that actually, for me, even stuff with internalized misogyny, that, like, you know, I'm a feminist, but obviously growing up in a society that is inherently misogynistic, you have to unlearn a lot of...
But how do you unlearn it?
Honestly, every time it happens, you kind of have to take a moment and talk to yourself a bit. Say, okay, that's interesting that you have that thought, or that's interesting that you feel that way. Why do you feel like that? And it's work. It is work. I mean, I've been in therapy as well since I was 17. So I think that I've been lucky enough to have that support around that, and to have someone, I suppose, maybe guide me through that, which not everyone, you know, has been fortunate enough to have, because I think it is.
Are you still in therapy now?
Oh, I am, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's just non-negotiable at this stage. I've had periods where, you know, I've come out of therapy, but I don't know. It's interesting because I go to the gym like 5 times a week because I want to stay physically fit. And no one says to me, are you going to go to the gym forever, or are you still going to the gym? Because we look at mental health and physical health in very different ways. And we understand to maintain physical health, there needs to be a consistency of practice. And to maintain mental health, there also needs to be a consistency of practice. And that doesn't necessarily mean that everyone has to go to therapy, even though I think we would be much better off for that. But